Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is John O'Farrell, and what a phenomenal career John O'Farrell has had and continues to have, and it's taken him in all different directions. He authored a wonderful book, Things Can Only Get Better, which I got the year it came out and have read multiple times. If you're a Labour person and you haven't read it, what are you mucking about at? But he's written so many great books. He's written West End musicals. He stood for Parliament twice. He's done so many fantastic and fascinating things. He has a new book out called Family Politics, which we'll talk about. But a lot of the threads in his life, it feels like, culminate around that book, and we talk about that. But just about writing topical comedy in general, writing comedy in 2024, being an author, so many different things. But his relationship with the Labour Party is such a big thing that runs through this interview, and his analysis of where the Labour Party is and of various different leaders is great. And he's got, as you would imagine, some fantastic stories. So I've put a link to Family Politics, his new book, so you can click on it and buy it. And please enjoy John O'Farrell. John, if we're going to talk about your books, we have to start with Things Can Only Get Better, which I got for Christmas the year it came out. And
fantastic.
I would rank among my favourite books, and you captured perfectly the feeling of not just, obviously, I don't remember the full 18 years of Tory rule, but the sense of negativity, you know, just of lost hope of all those years, but also fantastic stories about first working in politics. And when I think of that book, as well as the emotional reaction that I have from having read it so many times, the thing that I actually remember the most is the bit where you puke up when you're working for an MP. And there's a particular yes. way that you describe the cold saliva in your mouth.
That's many years of experience, I suppose. But that's funny you should remember that bit. I was thinking you might be going to that exact moment. I think it's something about my first sort of steps into the hallowed corridors of Westminster and the sort of grimy brutality of having a hangover and puking into one of those historic toilets. So it seems to stay with people, that bit of writing. It's weird.
Is that there's another line, and I think it's in Things Can Only Get Better, but it might be in The Best a Man Can Get, about being, I think, in a beer garden and all your worries being carried away on a foamy tide of ale.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't remember using those exact words. Every time I'm in a beer garden now, I think of that formulation of words.
A foamy tide of ale. I quite like that. I can't even remember writing it, but it's, thank you for remembering it. I'll have to search it on my computer and find out where I wrote that. But Things Can Only Get Better. It's funny. People say to me, oh, I read that book. I know your book. But the weird thing is, for some people, it's Things Can Only Get Better. For some people, it's a novel, different novel. Sometimes it's May Contain Nuts. Sometimes it's the history book. I'm the person who wrote that book to loads of different people, but it's not always the same book.
Were you surprised at the success of Things Can Only Get Better? I mean, obviously, the title, the phrase had been around a while. It's associated with the 1997 victory, but it's a political memoir, and from someone who obviously had a great career, but you weren't a celebrity. It's not like you're on telly all the time.
No, I was behind the screen. I was working in telly and working the other side of the camera. And it was writing that book that sort of got me on the other side. So it completely, you go to these literary events and they say, what is the book that changed your life? And I go, my book, the book I wrote changed my life. Because suddenly I was being interviewed and I got a column in The Guardian and I was on Question Time and Newsnight. So that was a huge surprise to me. I thought I was writing a book for politics nerds that would sit in the back of the bookshop and the politics shelves and be of sort of academic curious interest to those of us who had knocked on doors or sat on polling stations, you know. But it turns out lots of people sat in core at Labour Party meetings or Tory or Liberal meetings, because they all read it too. And I just captured something about that time, about, you know, a rites of passage story growing up in the Thatcher and Major years. And I think there was such a sense of release when we came out of that, that people, you know, wanted to surf that wave with me. Because I think that the follow-up, Things Can Only Get Worse, is as good a book, dare I say it. I think it's, as a piece of writing, I think it's sort of on a par, but it just didn't capture a moment. So I thought Things Can Only Get Better was a big success because I'd written a great book, but actually it was a big success because I just caught a mood. I was part of a feeling in the country.
Is there something actually in political messaging that explains partly maybe the fact that the follow-up's a bit harder is that Things Can Only Get Worse is a more negative title?
Yeah, and it was a more negative political journey. I sort of, when Brexit happened, I thought, how did we go from Blair and Tim Downing Street, Clinton in the White House, in those 18, 20 years, we went from that to Brexit and Trump. That's pretty impressive that we could cock it up so much. And I thought, well, that's an interesting journey. That's my external scaffolding. And I'd done lots of interesting things during that time, as well as stand for Parliament twice. So there was a lot to write about there. But you're right. It's not a good is eventually win. It's sort of a grimmer narrative arc.
When you think of how we got there, who is the we that you imagine? Is it the Labour Party and the way that it manages itself being partly to blame?
No, I think it's all of us on the left, all progressive people. People who choose to fight their campaigns outside the Labour Party or in. Anyone who should know better, really. So there's a lot of, angsting over, whether you should sort of criticise the leadership or whether you should protest against the Labour government. Opposition is much easier than power. Being against things is much easier than making things happen and being effective with responsibility. So if things are going to get worse, it's got a whole sort of story of me campaigning for a new school and then being the chair of the governors. And that was a sort of allegory, really, of how difficult it is to be in power because, of course, sometimes you have to exclude a child or have to make a sack a teacher. And those are the realities of being responsible and in control.
And how did you feel about the Corbyn years? Because obviously you described the Foot and Kinnock years and Things Can Only Get Better. And then you're still in the Labour movement when Corbyn comes along. And my view of Corbyn is actually that he sits completely outside of the Labour tradition, that he's not like Michael Foot at all. I felt Foot was someone steeped in the genuine history and the values of the Labour Party, whereas Corbyn actually was someone who really should always have been outside the tent.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sort of became leader by accident. My Things Can Get Worse ended at the 2017 election, which was sort of an amazing sort of result given all that we'd been through. And I was expecting us to get hammered. And that came at the following election. So anyone reading the book after 2019 is going, this book's a bit optimistic, isn't it? But my feeling about Corbyn was that he was just, I described it as like, my daughter, my 20-year-old daughter, suddenly dating a really inappropriate older man. It's just like, why is he the leader of this party? Why do we think this organization that is designed to win elections, or is intended to win elections and become the government, why have we got the leader of a protest group in charge of this opposition? So he's someone I could imagine would be great if you were trying to save the library or go on an anti-nuclear demo or organise a protest. But in terms of operational campaigning and seeking power, I think he's always on the outside of that and never someone who would have been suited for the realpolitik of running cabinets, organising the civil service and having a vision for how, maybe he does have a vision, maybe that's a bit unfair, but he's just not a prime minister, really. And that's always the thing I said in Things Gonna Get Better. Can you imagine them waving on the steps of Downing Street? And I don't think Jeremy Corbyn really fits that model.
Were you ever tempted to leave?
Do you know what? The only thing that happened to me was I didn't know quite how to vote in 2019 because my MP was Kate Hoey and the leader was Jeremy Corbyn, and I just thought, this isn't for me. This isn't me at all. I felt really weirdly personally sort of conflicted about it, that I was, my identity was sort of in flux. It's like, maybe I should become French. Maybe I need to change my gender. It's like, I remember stopping, walking my dog in the common, going, like, God, Kate Hoey, do I vote Labour with Kate Hoey and what she stands for in Brexit? I mean, normally I voted for her and I go, well, Ed Miliband's the leader, I'm voting for him, or, you know, Neil Kinnock's leader. But she went particularly mad at the end, and then Labour looked like they were just didn't know what they were doing at all. But I still voted Labour. I actually bumped into Neil Kinnock at a talk in central London. He goes, yeah, sorry about Kate, that's my fault, I imposed her on you. but you still got to vote Labour, John. He said, you have to vote Labour. What else? Of course you're Labour. And I sort of went, okay. And I sort of bit my lip and carried on. But I've been a Labour member under Foot, Blair, you know, Corbyn, Starmer. And the point is, it's almost a tribal thing, really. And they've, at every turn, they've been the best option available, which is sort of the point.
Keir Starmer's now, in polling terms, just so far ahead of Sunak, and Labour are now winning by-elections in the way that oppositions are meant to, but nevertheless winning in places that perhaps even Tony Blair wouldn't have dreamed of Labour winning. So despite what people might say about Keir Starmer, obviously there is an appetite for him and what he's done to the Labour Party. What's your assessment of his leadership so far?
He's done an incredible job in turning round the party from an absolute mauling in 2019, when I thought we were going to be out for several elections. I thought we'd be out for a decade at least after 2019. And he doesn't get much credit for the fact that he has made the Labour Party look credible and effective and a government in waiting. He has done that by absolutely refusing to fight on the hills that the Tories want to fight those battles. So, you know, we want to talk about refugees, and we want to talk about human rights, and we want to say you're going to have this much spent on the health service, or this much put aside for education. But he's not making any spending promises. He's not talking about anything that the government could get him on the ropes for, and that's very frustrating for us on the left. But we have to just look at the polls and going, his job is to get power, his job is to get us into power so we can start to be an effective government, and thousands of executive decisions will be taken every day by Labour ministers that will make a real difference to this country. You've worked for an MP, you know what it's like in power. It's not about your identity and how good you feel wearing a Labour Party badge. It's about what's effective in government.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was always on that side of things, and that's one of the many reasons that I left when Corbyn became leader, was thought this isn't a party serious about winning power again. And I dealt with people like him in meetings across Britain, and I knew that that veneer of someone who looks quite genteel, often an old guy with a white beard and a few pens in his pocket, they're often the most authoritarian bastard you'll ever meet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've never met Jeremy Corbyn, but and he seems like a sort of, you know, cuddly old, you know, granddad. But to be patronising for a minute, but what happened with his approach to Brexit has been enormously damaging to this country. If he had got the Labour Party behind the Remain campaign, it's quite possible that those people in all the Red Wall seats might have gone, oh, worse wages, union membership at risk, you know, all those things that could have got the Remain vote out might have saved it, might have kept us in the European Union. And I'll never forgive Corbyn for that, really.
So actually, Brexit's your biggest almost like political driver in recent years.
I suppose so. In terms of what a government can do and decisions that have been taken by voters of this country, you know, there's lots of things where you go, oh, the COVID was terrible and Ukraine is terrible and Gaza is terrible. But we chose Brexit. And the Labour Party at that point chose not to campaign hard against Brexit. And that seems to me an insane political decision. And it's done enormous damage to our economy. And I see it, you know, on a micro level every day. My daughter runs a, you know, small business exporting her T-shirts and stuff. And she just, it's such a hassle just to export something to Ireland, just to post something to France. And this is happening all up and down the country. Businesses are closing because those choices were taken.
You made your name as the lead writer on Spitting Image, the original Spitting Image.
Yes.
And on Have I Got News For You. I worked on the reboot of Spitting Image and the stage yeah. show. Someone that fell in between those stools, obviously there's quite a big gap in between. Mm. Various politicians missed out on being spitting imaged.
Right.
If you had to do a Jeremy Corbyn spitting image puppet, how would you go about it?
That's a good question. I suppose he'd be, like you say, the sort of the guy with the pens in the pocket and maybe just always trying to be against something and wanting to be like, you know, we should protest to the leader of the Labour Party. You are the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy. We should have a march. Yes. You know, we should, I'll sign a petition. Save the library. No, it's bigger than that, Jeremy. That's how I sort of see him, as a sort of, as an oppositionalist, really. Someone who is there to protest, and that leadership was sort of foisted upon him accidentally. And he never quite made that jump from being someone outside shouting at the window to someone who was inside on the other side of the window and didn't know quite how to react.
I always thought David Cameron would have been a great spitting image puppet. I thought he had a fantastic face and hair.
Yes.
I mean, I thought he was quite handsome and smooth.
Yeah.
It would have been quite nice to see a grotesque version of him.
Yeah, it was sort of those airbrush photos in the 2010 election. He did have a sort of slightly slimy porcelain face, doesn't he? And I think we could have had fun with that. Yeah, I don't. It's very hard. I can't just sort of. I guess I can't just summon up a characterization on the spot. And sometimes on Spitting, which we'd sit around and we'd spend the whole afternoon trying to talk about how to do, you know, Paddy Ashdown or how to do Norman Fowler. And sometimes you'd succeed and sometimes you didn't.
Because certainly according to Wikipedia, it was your idea to make John Major Gray.
Yes, it was my idea to make John Major Gray. I had thought it would be a piece of, it would require technology. My idea that he should always be in black and white and that everyone else was in colour. And I put this to Bill Dare. And he said, oh, that's a one sketch idea. And I went, well, and his usual positivity. And then I wrote something and the puppeteer just painted him grey. The puppet wranglers painted him grey. And it looked fantastic. It was so one of those things that's so obvious, but only after someone's done it. Do you know what I mean? So beforehand, no one was going, oh, he's obviously got to be grey. It was just once you'd seen it, it looked visually very striking. And it sort of just chimed with who he was and, you know, the contrast with what had gone before with strident Thatcher in her blue dress.
What was great about that was, for us working on the new one, and particularly more, I think, with the stage show, was you were always thinking about what is the way to characterise this person visually, and not just
yes.
what are their features that you want to bring out, but what other layer can you give to a puppet that says something satirical or something personal? And we did Suella Braverman as like a haunted childhood doll.
The Exorcist girl,
yes.
I saw her. I thought that was great. I thought that was one of the most striking ones because I came to the stage show and I enjoyed it. But it was, that was a very striking sort of characterization that she was like the green little girl from The Exorcist is what I imagined her.
Yes.
And it sort of had a ring of truth about it because it's just, that's the thing. It's got to sort of, you've sort of got to go, yes, when you see it. So Kenneth Blaker is a slug. People just went, yes, you know. That wasn't me. That was Stuart Silver. But I was in the room when we were, you know, writing those sketches. But yeah, it's the visual thing is, you know, very important to all of that. I didn't envy you with the challenge of rebooting Spitting Image because I thought so many of today's politicians come pre-satirized. You know, there's nothing you can put in Trump's mouth or Boris Johnson's mouth that they might not say anyway. It's
definitely true for those two, yes, was that they were such ludicrous characters that they'd created for themselves,
yes,
even visually, that
yes,
it did. They were slightly harder to do, even though there's still pleasure in the voice and the face and all, you know, it's still satisfying to see powerful people, you know, their trousers fall down or whatever, smacked in the face or puked on, or
yes,
all the silly stuff.
Yes, yeah, so I would say that when I started writing for Spitting Image in the 80s, the politicians and the royal family were still slightly on a pedestal. So there was still a sense of they needed bringing down in public estimation a little bit. And by the time you got on it, it was like, no, they are the lowest of the low in people's eyes. The royal family are in disgrace. The politicians are considered to be corrupt and venal and in it for themselves. And so, again, I thought that was more of a challenge to do that sort of satire.
Well, I think the television landscape has changed, is that it is harder to get punchier stuff on telly. That it's that broadcasters are more sensitive now about what the government thinks about what they put on their channels.
Well, we did. I've got a musical on in the West End right now called Just for One Day about Live Aid, and that was on Comic Relief last week. And they wanted a big 10-minute section. And we've got sort of what I think is a very funny section of Maggie Thatcher singing I'm Still Standing. And the Comic Relief said, yeah, that'll be brilliant. We'll do that. And we put it on. They said, we just have to, because it's Thatcher, we have politics, we have to refer upstairs. And they referred upstairs and the BBC went, absolutely not. You cannot do jokes about Mrs. Thatcher. This is an election year. It's like, well, the Representation of the People's Act hasn't come into force yet. What are you talking about? But it was like an absolute no. They were terrified to satirise Thatcher in the 80s. That would be like us and Spitting Image not being allowed to mention Suez in terms of the time frame. It's insane. It's just crazy. And they're terrified. They're also spineless and pathetic. It may be Red Cross.
It is very difficult to try and explain to people that what a straitjacket that can be, actually, creatively, and how, especially when you can see often harsher things online, not necessarily funnier, but certainly things that are punchier and you can go further online and certainly on the stage. And that was something that I found more liberating, was working on Spitting Image for the stage. Was really, the handbrake was off and you could do anything. And also what it really taught me was the public desire to see something really punchy has not diminished. The public really want to see it.
Yeah,
it's just that there's a kind of roadblock in the way that thinks people don't want to see this.
Oh, they're just worried about they're just worried about, you know, what is coming down the line for their jobs or what trouble they might get in from their boss who's under pressure from the Home Office or whatever. But, you know, a robust Director General would just tell the government to piss off and leave the BBC alone. And that's what we used to get in the 80s. I mean, I used to have to sign a contract every year on Spin Image, which was like, I guarantee, you know, undertake not to offend libel anyone living or dead. And it's like, that's the whole point of the program, is to be rude about people living or dead. But yeah, we had one sketch where we had a lawyer on Spitting Image who was just always like, took the approach of, would they sue? And the answer, of course, was no. And then one week we had a replacement lawyer who took the view, could they sue? And he came to us and we'd written this sketch with Mick Jagger in the 60s in bed with three blondes and a donkey. And he said, have you got any written evidence of Mick Jagger in bed with three blondes and a donkey? It's like, no, of course we haven't. The donkey is a funny puppet. And it's like, it's a rock and roll party. Of course, yes, here's this signed thing from Mick Jagger about the donkey. God's sake, you know.
You mentioned that musical. You've obviously done Mrs. Doubtfire, the musical as well, for the stage.
Yeah.
Have you? You've obviously ended up as well, another string to your bow, writing these musicals in the West End. Is part of that because you can say what you like on stage, and that's where your inclination has taken you for that reason?
I don't think it's that. I think just that I found television quite frustrating in terms of always writing pilot scripts and, you know, pilot sketch shows and not always getting commissioned and always having to come up against controllers who are wanting to copy the last thing that had been successful. And then I wrote books, and that was very liberating. And then I sort of stumbled into musicals, really. So an American writer asked me if I'd like to write one with him, and I did, and I really enjoyed the experience. I'd been sitting in a room on my own writing novels for 10 years. So suddenly to be writing something for actors and dancers and to be in a Broadway theatre was very exciting and a lovely change. So I sort of alternate between the genres now. I do musicals, I write books, and do bits of podcasting as well. I do a podcast with Angela Barnes about history. So I've got all sorts of different things that I do, which I enjoy.
It's a great photo of you and Bob Geldof in what looks like a rehearsal room, or it looks too sort of shabby to be a writing room, but maybe it was. What was he like to work with?
He was challenging. You know, he was very forthright. The way that theatre people talk to each other, it's hilarious, actually. They're sort of like, I think it's really fascinating what you've done there, dancing out of step. What would be really exciting if you could just dance in style. I'd just love to see that as an experiment. Would you do that for me, darling? That would be amazing. Then Bob Geldof walks in the rehearsal room and goes, this is fucking shite. This is fucking scene is shite. It's bollocks. And everyone's like, no one's ever had anyone talk to them like that before since they left theatre school. And he's usually talking to me, and I'm old enough and grizzled enough to take it. But it's still quite disarming when somebody tells you that what you've written is a piece of horse shit, and you have to then say it's not horse shit. You haven't quite seen how this will play, and just come into the rehearsal room and watch it, and then you'll understand. But he would lean across during the presentation and mime vomiting right in front of the actors, you know, to me. And I was say to him, you know, eyes front, Bob. They can see you. Those actors there can see you. They're right in front of you. So don't do that. But everything he did in terms of criticism or his agenda was usually about, pretty always about making the show better. It wasn't about his legacy or how he came across. He would say sometimes things like, that's not what I felt at the time, or I don't think I would say that. And I would change it accordingly because I think he has every right to say that. But what he doesn't have the right to do is say, Gemma wouldn't say that. It's like, well, I made up Gemma. So I know what Gemma would say, not you. Don't tell me what Gemma wouldn't say. And also he said Gemma would say fuck off. I said, she's an 18-year-old in my story. She's not going to tell this old man to fuck off. So yeah, I grew very fond of him, but it was quite, there were some moments where like, oh my God, he's wearing us down. And you can see that from the other people involved in Live Aid, that they were worn down by his sort of righteous certainty and his messianic zeal that's made the thing happen, really, because it never would have happened without that.
It's remarkable actually that he retains the stamina in that character, really. I mean, do you think part of it is him playing up to what people want Bob Geldof to be like, and they expect him to come in and ruffle a few feathers, and he's not being Bob Geldof if he doesn't do that?
Maybe. I think he just genuinely liked that. It's like he wouldn't, you know, I think if I just sort of replied to his email, yeah, we'll look at those and then hope he'd go away. You know, 3 days later, he'd go, well, what's the outcome? Let's see the evidence, you know. And so he didn't forget things. And he was, you know, very much, very on it the whole time. But yeah, he's definitely a one-off and a very sort of driven character. But he's also very funny, you know, and he sends me funny memes and makes me laugh. Some of his jokes are a bit inappropriate and some of them are quite funny. So he's a bit, you know, sends me dad jokes, you know, and it's funny. He's like someone I went to see when I was 16 as a pop star, and now I am working with him.
That's very cool, isn't it? I mean, I think that's one thing about this line of work, is that it opens doors that you weren't even aware existed. You end up working with people that would never have imagined being a comedian or a comedy writer you'd be in the same room as.
Absolutely. I mean, I spent time sitting in a room with Dave Allen, or I was, you know, when I was writing for Mel and Griff, writing the heads to heads for them. I watched them when I was in the sixth form, and I loved Not Like I Got News. And then suddenly I'm sitting there with them both improvising the head to heads. And I thought, well, God, how lucky am I? These were icons for me when I was growing up, you know.
And so much with your life. You've, as you say, stood for Parliament twice. Maybe there's a third time coming. Who knows?
I don't think so. Always intending to lose, I should add. I always knew I would lose. I wanted to be the Labour candidate, not the Labour MP. Yeah, sorry, Matt.
And some people who've not stood or been involved in campaigns will struggle to understand that. But you're basically doing the party a favour, aren't you? You're what's called a paper candidate to ensure
exactly.
You can vote Labour. But
yeah,
you know. I remember when I was a party organiser, getting someone to stand in a local election. I promised them it was as a paper candidate. And I got a phone call in the morning that said, you lying
he'd
bastard.
Won.
He'd won, yeah, and he was livid. No. So you ruined my life.
That's hilarious.
That's terrible.
I mean, there was a chance I could have won the Eastleigh by-election if the, because it was the Liberals versus the Tory. Those were the two main challengers, but they were in coalition at the time. So if people had sort of, if the votes had coagulated around the coalesced, I mean, coagulated might be better actually, coalesced around the opposition, then maybe I could have, a bandwagon could have got going. But in fact, it came around, it was UKIP, and they nearly won it.
Eastleigh obviously was ferocious following the resignation of Chris Huhne, and standing in a by-election, even being involved in a by-election as an activist, is unlike any other experience. It is a firestorm, and the national media there, sometimes the international media are there.
Yeah.
They are the dirtiest, foulest campaigns you can be in, but they're also the most thrilling. I mean, did you find it a bruising experience at all?
Yeah, I did really, because when I went for the, basically Ed Miliband's office rang me up and asked me if I'd be the candidate. They went through all the celebrity Labour supporters, and then they all said no. And like, Ed Miliband was under the impression that I was a bigger name than I actually am. But anyway, they asked me if I would be the Labour candidate because they thought, well, we need to raise the Labour profile in this, you know, seat where we might otherwise disappear. So at that point, it looked like a smart idea. I did say to the National Executive Committee when I was interviewed, you do know that I wrote these books and I put things about my, you know, graffitiing jobs, not bombs, on around walls of Exeter. And I, you know, my views about Thatcher and the Brighton bomb and the miners' strike. They said, oh, it's right. Anything that's in the public domain, you don't have to worry about. I don't think the Daily Mail ever got that memo. So the first Sunday, there's a big picture of me laughing with the Brighton bomb having gone off behind and Tebbit being brought out of the rubble, and a bit about what I wrote about the Brighton bomb going off and things are going to get better. And then people were shouting, traitor, you should be shot at dawn. You know, I was the 2-minute hate that you get on Twitter was suddenly focused on me. And I was basically a member of the IRA for a few weeks, as far as they were concerned. And that was quite unnerving. Poor Rachel Reeves had to come on a walkabout with me around this florist. This man was shouting, saying he would shoot me. And I was trying to talk about dahlias and delphiniums. It was quite surreal, you know.
And of course,
so yes, it was vicious.
Being a member of the IRA for a brief period must have been the first time you met Jeremy Corbyn.
Absolutely. He offered to lend me his balaclava.
But it is. People don't understand that. They think, oh, you just mean that it's maybe intense. I mean, it is dirty tricks, and it is. There's a lot of mind games involved. Things often descend into literal physical fights at street level. I can't believe there isn't more coverage about how appalling by-elections are in this country. I mean, it's quite funny in retrospect, but at the time, it can be petrifying. And to be thrust into the national spotlight like that when you're a decent guy, you're a calm fellow, you know, you're being made out to be an extremist, it must feel quite exposing.
Yeah, it was okay. What I felt disappointed, I didn't expect to win or intend to win, but I felt all those young activists, and it was a very young team, were working 12, 14 hours a day on this campaign. And the moment that the local paper put it on their front page, and the news and the BBC ran with the male agenda, which was a bit disappointing. They just went, oh, that's the difficult question for the Labour guy. And so the Jonathan just became, oh, that bloke who wanted the Brighton bomb to work. And it's like, I was going, that's not what I said. It's not what I said. But I felt that I was letting them down. I felt that they were working really hard we weren't even going to increase the Labour vote. We might even lose. We might come fourth or something. And we did come fourth, but, you know, the Tories came third in what was supposed to be a Tory seat. So some of that damage was really inflicted on them rather than Labour. Tiny increase in the Labour vote there. But the big story of that election was that the UKIP nearly won it. And that was the breakout moment for UKIP, really, before they won the European elections.
There's a phenomenon referred to as candidatitis, where even in the most unwinnable seats, at some point during the campaign, the candidate believes they will win. Did you ever suffer from it?
I thought, oh, maybe I could win. I tell you what, there was when they announced me, there was a bit of a sort of, oh, that's an interesting choice. And people going, oh, it might be fun to have someone like that in the House of Commons. And the bookies went to, brought me down from 100 to 1 down to 50 to 1. And I was down to 6 to 1. And I thought, well, this is going in one direction. And then weirdly, during the middle of the campaign, like a week into the campaign, you're allowed to see some of the postal votes. They open up this ballot box and you see the postal votes, which seems very undemocratic. The bookies must have had someone in that room because, A, there was a massive pile for UKIP there, which we hadn't seen coming. And then the bookies must have had someone there because I went straight out to 101 again because I thought I went, but, you know, you got the lay of the land. You saw which way the tide was going. And that seems like a weird way of doing things. But I knew at that point, oh, I'm not going to win this. And our job is to sort of just, even if we can increase the Labour vote, that will be an achievement.
And Labour were actively looking, as you put it, for a celebrity name. I can't figure out whether that's a really good idea or not.
I
guess the thing is, you
idea.
Are an actual Labour person with a history in the party, so it wasn't just like you were plonked there.
I think they wanted someone that the papers might have heard of, something that was, there was at least there was something to discuss. They asked a Daily Mirror writer, I'm trying to remember what her name was, Fiona, which I found out because she put it in her column. So yeah, I'm sure they went down the whole list and asked, you know, Joe Brand and anyone else who has ever sort of publicly supported Labour before they got to me. But I actually thought it's 3 weeks. It was a really short campaign, 3 weeks. What else was I going to be doing? And it was an incredible experience, really. And it ended up being a great chapter in my book. So that was never foreseen. But it was, it was a very bruising experience. And the novel that I've just published, Family Politics, is set, you know, at the backdrop of a fiercely contested by-election. So I suppose I've used it for that as well, because the whole arc of that campaign is the backbone of the new novel.
You've robbed me of my neat segue, which was going to on to the new book. But you're ahead of me. You're a far more talented writer, and you've beat me to it.
Here's a cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact: you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So that neatly takes us on to Family Politics, which a lot of the themes in the book we've mentioned. There's a backdrop of a by-election, but also one of the things in it is about a character effectively challenging the politics of the parents. Yes. I wonder how much of this is based on your personal experience.
None of it, I should say. That there's no way that either of my two children are anything other than solid left-wing, reliable, progressive people who educate me on their politics. But and this is a big but, after 30 years of my daughter seeing me supporting Fulham, going to Craven Cottage, coming to the games when she was a little girl, she's just turned around to me and said she supports Arsenal now. And it's like, well, I've disowned her. This is it. I'm cutting her out of the will. She's going to have to move out of the spare room. That's it. I only have one child now. I only have a son. I always wished I'd have a daughter, but it was never going to happen.
So that's the only 30.
Well, she's just going out with this boy who supports Arsenal, and lots of her friends are in North London and they support Arsenal. She's been going to the Arsenal women's games. It's like, have you seen the work that Fulham do with refugees, Lily? On that basis alone, you should be supporting Fulham. So, yeah, well, anyway, so that's the only bit of it I can say. But I mean, in terms of all the politics, like you say, Labour coming through the whole Corbyn sort of turmoil was really the other part of the genesis of this book, about A, the divisions within the Labour Party, but also just the way politics has gone and the way it's become so performative and so much about how left-wing you look, as opposed to what you can actually achieve. I wanted to explore that. And just the whole way that we are such a divided society now, as post-Brexit, I thought having an actual family split down the middle like this, it was an interesting way of doing it, because normally the grown-up kids come back from university and berate their parents for not being left-wing enough. I thought, well, flip it on its head. He comes back a Tory, and the parents were like, think they were really progressive and tolerant, but this is the one thing they cannot tolerate.
And what is your view of this performative, progressive? I mean, I sort of resist calling it progressive because I actually think a lot of it's very regressive. But what about the sort of performative left-wingness? Do you put it all down to social media, or do you think there is something else going on?
No, it predates that. When I was at university, there were people who are prolier than thou. Do you know what I mean? They were like, wanted to show you how left-wing they are rather than actually change anything. And that is, I actually really think it's quite right-wing. Because it's all about the individual. It's all about me and how much better I am than you and how superior I am in my politics. And it's about the individual, not about, it's about me, not us. And that's why people who say I'm very left wing, I am, and they say that's why I've resigned from the Labour Party. I'm thinking, well, that's, you're helping the Tories get in if you do that. It doesn't make you left wing. So I don't really, I try not to attack people on the left. I try to focus all my attention on the Tories and you know, the other reactionary parties. But I want Labour to win elections, and I want Labour to be radical, and I want Labour to be left wing. But I'm not going to have a pop at Keir Starmer when he's got an election to fight.
And just thinking about the themes in the book, such a funny idea to have a young lad come home and effectively come out as being a Tory. It's such a great idea, and to have a child challenge the politics of the parents, and have it that way round. But just think about when you talk about politics with your son and daughter, leaving football out of it. Do they challenge you and say, "Oh, Dad, your generation don't get it. You're a boomer, and things are different there."
They don't say it quite as in such an unsophisticated way. But my daughter, you know, is educates me on gender politics and on feminism. And my son is a very effective charity worker working with in the education charity sector. So they're both sort of in their jobs, surrounded by these issues, and will pick me up on sort of some of my knee-jerk, old-fashioned left-wing ways. And that's great because it's, you know, it's good to be challenged and to have the Mickey taken out of you for being, you know, having this comfortable generation that could afford to buy a house and get a job writing jokes to the BBC. That was just something that I thought was normal, but I realised I was part of a very privileged sort of subsection of the population.
And what do you make? I mean, gender politics is such a is the issue of the day, really, and gender politics and the trans debate and things like that. I mean,
I
what do you think
think
about where
it's,
this goes?
I don't know where it goes. My feeling about it is, of course, everyone has the right to be identify as whatever they want, and we have to be very respectful of people how they want to be addressed. But this is not an end to a means. This is not going to end poverty or stop the war in Gaza or stop global warming. And that involves us all working together and focusing on the macro issues rather than what seems like a really important thing of, you know, how I am accepted as for what I am. And this is very easy for me to say as a white middle class man. So I tread very carefully when I talk about this. But when I was in Broadway in 2015, 2016, we were. So much discussion was about gender neutral toilets and pronouns, and Trump was winning Iowa and Trump was winning Pennsylvania, and you're going, guys, can you not see this is what we need to be talking about, how we stop this juggernaut coming towards us. And so you can do both. You can respect people's identity and allow them their rights, their full and equal rights, however they identify. But it shouldn't be the be all and end all of your politics. That has got to be about other people, not oneself.
There does seem to be a danger sometimes on the left. I mean, Labour's never elected a female leader.
No.
And often these things are at the expense of women. It's women's rights that get eroded. And I find it slightly, well, I find it deeply concerning that lots of people who would identify as progressive don't realise how deeply regressive some of these things are.
I think the problem with the women leader thing has just, it's just one of those thing bad luck things that the Tories have done it more often than us. I just think Margaret Thatcher got elected leader by accident, actually. She was supposed to be a stalking horse candidate. And then Theresa May got elected by accident because everyone else had stabbed each other in the back and she sort of stepped lightly over the bodies. And then Liz Truss, it was a total aberration. So, and yet with Labour, you know, we had I voted for Yvette Cooper when Corbyn got in. And that was again a freak sort of result that no one saw coming over the hill. And maybe if there'd been a left wing sort of campaign group candidate after Miliband, that woman might have got in. I don't know. But yeah, there is something on the left where you go, this is really important. My issue is really important. Quiet women, I'm getting on with this. So it has to be, women's rights have to be part of the whole macro solution. And there's a lot of it's still very traditional sometimes in parties that the you get these men who talk a lot. And I've got lots of jokes in the family politics about Eddie the dad saying, he says over and over again as a feminist and sort of talks over the women who are waiting to ask questions at the gender and diversity forum. And so I've written it in the voice of a first person female narrator, which is always an extra challenge. But I hope that no one has so far said that was the bit that bothered me. I've had people say I didn't like this about the book or that about the book. But to put your head into the mind of a woman narrator is an extra challenge as a writer.
Yes, and it's a good challenge, isn't it? But do you, there's a lot of talk now about whether actors can play particular parts based on their gender, race, sexuality, whether they have any disability or not. I mean, do you think that this hasn't perhaps happened in the same way in publishing yet? But, on a slow news day, could a white man, John O'Farrell, actually be the centre of a storm where someone says, you're effectively appropriating a female voice? This is inappropriate.
I doubt they would do that because anyone else, I'm not stopping someone else from writing a book. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm taking up space on a bookshelf in a bookshop that might have been taken by a woman writer. My feeling about the acting thing is that there are for years women, black people have been underrepresented in these art forms, and of course, we should have diverse casting, and it's perfectly fine to have a black man play Hamlet. Of course, it's there's a million different things that you could say about Hamlet. He was young. He has a beard in the play. He's played with people without beards. He's Danish. He doesn't have to be Danish to play Hamlet. It never has been. So, of course, why not have a perfectly interesting, and we understand that they are pretending, so it's probably reasonable to have Glenda Jackson to play King Lear. I can get my head around that because they are actors. So, and so if a, and but it's not, it shouldn't be an equal playing field. You shouldn't have white people blacking up to play Othello because they did that. Those people have had all those opportunities. There's plenty of parts for white actors. So I don't do the thing of, oh, it's one rule for them or one rule for the others. And so, yes, let black people play Hamlet. Let black people play Othello. I completely get my head around that. And I think the sort of it's become this thing where people want to go, it's ridiculous. It's sort of fodder for Daily Mail editorials, really. And we shouldn't really sort of play into their sort of their culture war nonsense.
Do you ever worry about cancel culture or a joke of yours? I mean, I guess you went through the experience in the by-election where historic material was used and deliberately taken out of context. But do you feel the pressure as a satirist, as an author in the modern era, of perhaps a protest at something that you've written?
Well, I just wrote Just for One Day for the Old Vic Theatre, and it's a politically charged subject. Here's a white man going out to Africa, raising all this money with these old white male pop stars. And I wanted to, but for me as a political person, I wanted to head into that. I wanted to say, so I had a young woman of color from the outset going to Bob Geldof, what? So basically, a load of old white guys taking one day off and snorting cocaine to help Africa. That was her way into this. And Bob Geldof goes, that's not true. They did not take one day off from snorting cocaine. So, so I'm a political person, and my politics has evolved, and I want to be political about these things. So when did we say cancel? I don't know. Cancel what? Cancel you from doing homophobic jokes? Cancel you for doing racist jokes? I mean, I wouldn't want to do a joke that was punching down anyway. So I don't feel worried about being cancelled. I want to hear what the new sensibilities are and explore those and write within the parameters that I feel are true and fair, I suppose.
Mrs. Doubtfire, the musical, got fantastic reviews, and it's obviously a classic film. And putting that on the stage was such a thrill for people to see. And obviously, you've done Chicken Run, two films of Chicken Run as well. So you've got a great mix of shows like the Live Aid one that allow you to explore your politics through a fantastic, iconic story, and then ones that, I mean, how do you end up Working on Mrs. Doubtfire the musical.
Well, we were asked, we after I did the first musical I did was a thing called Something Rotten, which ran on Broadway for 2 years, a sort of Shakespearean musical, which was great fun. And that was my way into musical theatre. Then we, because of that, we got asked to do the adaptation of Mrs. Doubtfire. And I thought, well, that's an exciting prospect. But again, it's I'm taking a very successful movie, a brilliant characterization by Robin Williams. But it's, and then, you know, the question was, how do you do that without Robin Williams? And it's sort of as soon as you go and see it and he starts singing, you realize it is, it's something different. It's its own thing. It's a musical. And but we took some of the jokes from the film and we came up with some new jokes of our own and we modernized that. So that's a very white male show, actually. The TV boss is a, you know, old white man. The court liaison officer is an old white woman. We mixed that all up a bit and modernized that. And that's sort of just being 21st century about it. But it was great fun. But I don't feel as proud of that as I would do for Just for One Day, because it's a I've taken someone else's story, a novel by Anne Fine, a great script by Randy Myam Singer, and I've turned it into a musical by, you know, John O'Farrell and the Kirkpatrick brothers. So it's very third hand, really, what I've done there. I've done a good adaptation as opposed to created an original story, as I did with Just for One Day.
Do you get people coming to you saying, right, would you do, can you do Jurassic Park, the musical for us, or Basic Instinct, the musical? I mean, how many classic films are landing on your desk as pitches now?
I have had other ones come to me and I've turned them down because I don't really think that's well, the test they say in musical theatre is, does it sing? So the, you know, Jurassic Park, would you go, oh no, there's a dinosaur coming over the hill? You know, it's not something where you feel minded to burst into song. Whereas with I'm going to lose my kids, that's something to sing about. I want to get my family back together. That has the stakes that sort of justify bursting into song. So that's the sort of test that we apply. Does it feel like a musical? And one or two of the other ideas that were put before us were like, well, it's a popular title, but I don't think it's feels like a song that should be singing and dancing in that story. So, you know, I'm not going to do the Black Death, the musical. You know, it's not going to happen. Though we do have a song called Black Death in the first one.
You did a bit of stand-up comedy and decided it wasn't for you. What is the instinct within you then that knows you're funny, that knows you can write, but then doesn't want to be the person saying the lines?
The thing about stand-up comedy is it's such a all-consuming genre. You've really got to want to hone that craft and be really focused on owning that stage. And I just thought that I would be a okay stand-up comic, and I did okay. I won a competition for Jongleurs in Battersea, and I played there a couple of times. Then I did a terrible gig when I changed all my material and was sort of booed off the stage, which was quite difficult for a 23-year-old man. But I just knew the reason I was doing it was really to have an outlet for stuff I wanted to write. And I just thought I'm better at writing than I am. You know, I thought I was a good writer. I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to be false in what I see and say I cannot write comedy. I clearly can because I've been doing it for 40 years. But with stand-up comedy, I just think I'd be okay. And I thought, well, let's do something I excel at rather than something that I would muck along and probably be on, you know, a panel show on Dave right now, or struggling to stay on that panel
Hey,
show, not
nothing
even
wrong with that.
replaced. Sorry. <I'm>
Some of us have made a perfectly good living out of
Yeah,
panel shows
sorry,
and out
sorry.
of Dave.
Yeah.
So you also addressed the Labour Party conference in 1999. Was that at a fringe event or was that in the main conference hall?
No, I did the main thing, the main
Jesus
wrapping up in 1999.
Christ.
There's about 5,000 people in that thing. And I did a set. I did a sort of funny set. And it was amazing to talk, to do comedy to that many people. You'd hear the laugh sort of go up like a wave up the room. And I sort of did some jokes about the Tories were in such disarray. And I had this whole spiel. And it was amazing, actually. It was great. And I'd done that same week. The book, everyone on the train on the way down was reading Things Can Only Get Better. I'm literally everyone. Blair mentioned it from the platform. Prescott mentioned it from the platform. Everywhere I went inside that building, everyone wanted to get my autograph or have a picture taken with me for smartphones. And so in that very weird sort of micro bubble, I was a big celebrity at that point inside the Labour Party. And so they, you know, they were delighted to have me speak from the stage at the end in the wrapping up sort of funny bit. And yeah, that was that lasted for a few years, and I sort of did the thing. The way I helped the Labour Party was going to local constituencies and doing after dinner speeches, and they'd get sort of 300 people when I do the auction, and that was better than delivering leaflets and knocking on doors. So that was my outlet for my stand up in a funny sort of way. I make them laugh by taking the piss out of the Tories and asking them to buy a raffle ticket.
So you must have met a lot of Labour Party leaders. What was
Yeah,
Blair
I've
like?
met.
What was Blair like with you?
He was very pleasant. I mean, I went to Chequers a couple of times and had dinner with Jimmy Savile. You know, always a pleasure. And I sat next to Cherie, and I'd just written Things Gonna Get Better, and she said, "What's your new novel that you're writing about?" I said, "It's about how hard it is, you know, in a marriage when a new baby comes along. It's about, you know, the pressure that puts on a marriage." And little did I know that she was not drinking wine because she was pregnant. So that was weird.
Even
But
the Jimmy
he
Savile
was
one. Surely it
the
wasn't
Jimmy.
just you, Jimmy Savile, Tony, and Cherie.
No, there was Judi Dench there and Michael Williams. There was the guy from Creation Records and
Alan
his
McGee.
partner, Alan McGee, who was there. And there was John Reid. It was actually surreal. Jimmy Savile had this. We're standing around. First of all, it's 1999. It was a great time to be a Labour supporter. Blair was still very much in his honeymoon period. And I was standing there in this sort of beautiful Jacobean stately home. All these paintings and this lovely wooden panelled wall. Suddenly, I'm aware that Jimmy Savile has put this poster up on the wall with his blue tack, and it's a picture of a naked lady. It was written across her body, "Oh Lord, please send me Sir Jimmy Savile." And everyone sort of falls quiet and looks to Tony Blair, and Judi Dench looks to Tony Blair, and I look to Tony Blair, and Tony Blair shrugged and he went, "Well, he does do an awful lot of work for charity." It's like, and that was their way of saying we had to have him. This is obviously before all the stuff came out about him, because that was after he died. But little Blair's daughter, Catherine, she was 13, and she said to my wife, "Who's that man?" And Jackie said, "Oh, he's on television when I was your age." She goes, "I don't like him at all." I thought, well, that's really, really interesting that she got a really creepy vibe off him. But he never came again after he touched up Alan McGee's wife all night. And he went many times to Chequers under Thatcher, and just once to the Blairs. He does a lot of work for Stoke Mandeville, which was just down the road from Chequers. So there was this sort of obligation, I think. Yeah, she didn't have him back. But you never know who you're going to meet in this crazy old business.
No, that's right. Or have your photo with, and that's there forever to haunt you. Thinking of the current leadership then, have you met Keir Starmer?
Yes, I've met him. I've had dinner with him and played football with him. You know, he starts out on the left and drifts to the centre, obviously, for much. I like him. And he's a very serious person, a very serious politician. And he's a grown up. Do you know what I mean? And it's just such a breath of fresh air to have a grown up leading to be a grown up, going to possibly be our next prime minister, or hopefully be our next prime minister. Someone who actually wants to affect change rather than score points off the other side. And just sort of maneuver for sort of advantage. He's actually wants to change the country.
And what is he like at football?
He's really good, actually. I mean, he's actually got a bit of an injury at the moment, but he's pretty solid midfielder. Takes it quite seriously. He runs his own game in Kentish Town, and if people are late twice, you know, they never come back. So
Oh,
he's very tough. Oh, yeah, me
I love
too. I
that.
can't bear people being turning up with their hangovers and going, "Oh, I couldn't get it together." It's like, "Well, you're out, mate." And that's going to be the same in the cabinet. Turn up with a hangover, Rachel. And yeah, you're out of the cabinet if you turn up late twice for the hangover. Don't bring the right kit.
Punctuality is like,
Yeah,
I hate litter and I hate being late. I hate
it's
being
just
late for
great.
other people. I hate keeping people
It's
waiting. I hate it when I'm kept
rude.
waiting.
It's rude to be
It
late.
is
That's why I tell my
selfish.
kids lateness is rudeness. Some people are pathologically late. My old co-writer, Mark Burton, was pathologically late. If he was on time for somewhere, you could see him start to get nervous and start thinking, "Oh, just go to the bank." So, Mark, we're on time. Stop it. I don't
You
know what it
worked
is,
in
but anyway, yeah.
politics for a bit then, and you're obviously still involved in it. Is there part of you that thinks, actually, I would have loved to have a career in it and ended up either as a member of parliament or as an advisor?
Yeah, I think if I hadn't, it's funny because in 1987, I was 25 and I was working for Alf Dubs MP in Battersea, and I was getting
No
paid several
way.
days a week for that. I was a parliamentary researcher. But at the same time, I was starting to get sketches on Weekending, on the days that I wasn't going into Westminster, I was going to the BBC and getting stuff on the radio. And he said to me, "After the election, I'll try and get you some more days so you can be full time." And I was thinking, wow, well, that's great, but I really am making some headway finally as a comedy writer. And the voters of Battersea sacked Alf Dubs, made that decision for me. It's like, oh, Alf's not an MP anymore. That option is no longer there. So I am going to be a comedy writer. And that's what I did. My daughter said to me the other day, what would you do if you hadn't been a writer? And I said, I might have worked in politics in some way or other. I don't know if I really want to be an MP. It's a tough old job and an antisocial job. And everyone thinks you're on the make and, in it for yourself. And you spend a lot of time traveling and away from home and it breaks up families. So it's a tough thing. Maybe I would have done something on the fringes of politics, in Westminster. Maybe I would have been a support part of the support team or in a charity or something. I don't know, or a NGO. But comedy writing, it's a nice job. Sitting around at my desk, thinking up jokes and hearing people laugh at them, it's very pleasant.
And obviously you do it so well in your books and shows have entertained people for so long now. Obviously family politics is out at the moment. How often do you sort of think, do you think I should do a book every other year and what's my next one going to be?
I'm just at that point now, actually. I would like to do a book a year if I had the energy and the creativity. My publisher's always like, can we get another one this time next year? That would be amazing. I go, I would, except I'm doing this show or I'm doing this movie.
I'm doing
But
Schindler's
no,
List, the
I'm
musical.
doing it's just the musical. Yeah, God help us. But yeah, it's a great thing to write a book. It's a great privilege to get published, but it's also a bit lonely. So that's why I divide it up a bit and ring the changes a bit. I haven't got an idea for a new book or a new novel. I'm going to sit down and try and come up with one and hopefully, just spend a year sitting in by my desk or in the London Library where I like to write and just try and crack another story out because I do love just creating stories and characters and just seeing where it goes.
Well, John, your books are fantastic. Family politics
Thank
is
you.
superb. And
Thank you.
well, but things can only get better, I think. Certainly for Labour people is a real probably the most influential non-manifesto since the Ragged Trousers Philanthropists.
Which also features in my new book. Yeah, thank you. The Things Gonna Get Better was it just caught the mood and it chimed with people. And I saw last night Dame Helena Kennedy came to Just for One Day, and when I spoke to her, I told her that I was the author of that book. Her whole demeanor changed. Went, oh, you're him. Oh, that book. And it's just for a certain generation of Labour people, it is so iconic, which is lovely. And, Margaret McDonald told everyone who joined the Labour, everyone who worked at Woolworth Road had to read it. They said, you've got to read this book so you understand where we're coming from and what's gone before. And I think everyone felt like that. And it was just a sort of part of the Labour identity to share that collective experience. So we'd all been there and we'd all done it. And so I'm forever grateful for that book. That was the book that changed my life and allowed me to write these other books, including Family Politics, which is me finally combining my love of writing about politics, my love of writing about families. Finally, I came up with, oh, family politics. There's an idea.
John, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt. Lovely to be on the show.
Well, there you go, John O'Farrell. What a fantastic guest and such a great person to talk to. And someone who really has allowed their talent to take them in so many different directions. And I find that so inspiring. But someone who's tribally Labour, and I always find that very interesting because I always thought I was. And then it turned out I wasn't, because although I would, of course, say that for a few years it wasn't Labour. But so interesting talking to him about working on Spitting Image back then and deciding that John Major should be grey and all things like that. So many great moments. And he is just a joy to listen to. So, as well as writing, actually, even though, he decided being on stage wasn't for him. In an interview, he's absolutely phenomenal. So he's also master of the spoken word as well as the written. I'll be back next week with another fantastic guest. Until then, please leave a 5-star written review, share it far and wide, tell your family and your friends about it, and I'll see you next time. Ta-ra!
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.